This is Just the Right Book, and I'm Roxanne Cody of RJ Julia Booksellers. Each week, I hope to bring to you the stories behind the books, talking with some of the very best contemporary nonfiction authors, books that are timeless and charming, provocative, and of the moment. The conversations you want to hear about the books you need to read. We are joined today by Tim Wu. He is a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times. He is also an author, policy advocate, having written about net neutrality theory, private power, free speech, copyright, and antitrust. His books, The Master Switch and The Attention Merchants, have won deserved wide recognition and awards. Wu has also worked for federal and state government, including a stint at the White House on the National Economic Council. He was a law clerk for Justice Breyer. He's been named to Politico 50 twice, to America's 100 most influential lawyers, and in 2017 was named to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He joins us today as the author of his latest book, The Curse of Bigness. In this short, persuasive, provocative, and historically grounded book, Tim shows us how allowing unrestricted growth of concentrated private power can feed an appetite for nationalist and even extremist leadership. I am delighted to have this important conversation. Tim, welcome to Just the Right Book.
Sure. Pleasure to be here.
So, Tim, the subtitle of your book is Antitrust in the New Gilded Age. So why don't we ground this conversation in talking about the original Gilded Age?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we have a bad way of remembering the original Gilded Age. We sometimes just think it was a lot of dinner parties, fancy times, but, you know, because movies contribute to that. But I think I want us to recall the economic conditions of the Gilded Age. So there were two things I think were really important. One, you had an enormous gap in wealth and income between the poor and the rich. So there was the emergence of a new class of ultra-rich, something had never been seen before. At the same time, and I think parallel, is you have the economy reorganized into a series of trusts, which were monopolies. So you had one company for every industry. And destruction of all the little companies and small businesses. And you had Standard Oil, which everybody knows, but you also had, you know, trust for tobacco and cigarettes, another monopoly for rubber, for nails, so on and so forth. So that was the condition. Centralized, unequal. I think there was a reason that it gave birth to so many extreme political movements at the time and eventually that very much changed the way Americans live.
And the conditions that allowed these trusts to exist. They were created as a mechanism for doing business. And how long were they able to monopolize what was going on? And then who became concerned about it and why?
Right. So they monopolized their industries. They had the idea that competition was bad. Small business was bad. The future lay in large sort of monopolized businesses that would run every industry
and be
perfectly
efficient and
super efficient, supposedly. And, you know, run by one great man.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way they organize. They also enrich the people at the top. That was another reason. And
yeah.
Enriched and the, had a lot to do with
that. So two of the prominent people in those days are names that are known.
Yes.
John D. Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan.
Yes. And they actually figure in the book as well. And yeah, that was the vision. But, you know, it engendered some of the, you know, since the American Revolution, some of the greatest popular uprisings, I think, in U.S. history. People were angry. They didn't think this was the American way. The United States had been a country of rough equality for a long period, you know, sort of the frontier. And no one could believe it. And so it led to a lot of developments. You know, actually, had socialist movements, anarchist movements, but also less radical movements, the antitrust movement being one of them. The idea that we should break the trust, that we were against the trustification of the American economy. That led ultimately to the Sherman Act, which is big in this book.
Right. And so the Sherman Act established a principle of what was a monopoly and what was necessary to break up. How was the definition of the Sherman Act defining that? Because that's certainly been weakened and changed over time.
Well, the Sherman Act was very broad. It just said that monopolization was illegal. It said that agreeing on restraints of trade were illegal. So it basically illegalized the trust form. And if it's just a few sentences, really, and it took, frankly, Theodore Roosevelt and the courts to activate it, to turn it into a law that made monopolization illegal and actually broke up trusts into small pieces. So that was the tenor of the law. The idea was that to monopolize an industry was illegal, and if you did that, you would be broken into pieces.
And so the Supreme Court justice that has been identified closely aligned with the Sherman Act was Brandeis, who you talk about in the book. And Brandeis had a wide view of it. And there was one, I'm not sure if this is his language, but this is language from the book that I thought was fascinating. And I don't know that it's the way people even think of antitrust coming close to. But you say the broad tenor of antitrust enforcement, the broader goals of enforcement, should be animated by a concern that too much concentrated economic power will translate into too much political power and thereby threaten the constitutional structure, meaning it could actually preempt government sovereignty.
Yes, that was a big tenor of the popular movement against the trusts, and maybe I should have said it earlier. But people were angry. They felt that not only were the trusts so economically powerful, but they had government in their pocket, that they had created, the word was, an invisible government that hovered above the one you see out there and told them what to do. There's a famous editorial cartoon in the period, which has Congress in the foreground sitting in session, and behind them you have the great monopolists just sort of deciding what the actual decisions are. So as much as anything, the philosophy of the Sherman Act was to smash the idea that monopolies would run not just the economy, but frankly, the whole country. And in that period, they had great influence, particularly over the Republican Party before Roosevelt. They basically dictated economic policy for the United States. And eventually people said, we just cannot stand this.
And so how does that then lead to the possibility of a fascist government or an authoritarian? Because I thought about this. I had the opportunity last week to interview Madeleine Albright for her book called Fascism, A Warning. And she talks about other warning signs that we should look at. But one of the things that she also talks about is how inequality begins to make people lose faith in a democratic government as being able to help them. How does antitrust and monopolies exacerbate that condition?
Yeah, so that's good. I think that for me, the place to look for that is the immediate post-World War II situation, where people are studying carefully the examples of Japan and Germany. And one of the things that Japan and Germany both had was monopolization, cartelization of their economies. They did not have antitrust laws. They did not wage war on the trust. In fact, they accepted and even promoted the idea of a trust economy. And some of the results of that were incredible economic suffering, incredible concentration of wealth into a small group, and a people who felt that they were being left behind, that they were unrepresented in this process. And that, I think, most people agree, led to the kind of volatile conditions that led fascist leaders able to take power by appealing to economic misery. Now, there's a subtle thing that happens, very complicated, which is that, in fact, Hitler's leaders like Hitler were supported by the monopolists, ultimately. So there's two sides to it. One is this widespread economic inequality and misery. The other is the ability to cooperate. A fascist leader, if they are in cooperation with just a couple of monopolists, they suddenly have this incredible union of private and public power, which was the story of Japan, the story of Germany, private and public allied in this effort to take over the world. And I think those economic origins of fascism must be always watched. So domination of the economy by monopolists tends to create this inequality, concentration of wealth at the top, broad-based misery, which creates the conditions for a revolution, for a strong leader who's going to fix things, for a savior, especially if there's been an economic depression.
Right.
Some kind of crash. We even saw some of this in the United States in the 30s as well. But the fascist leaders, there's another direction there's a second step, which is very subtle but very important, which is having so much private power in so few hands means that if a leader like Hitler can gain the support of a majority or even a
even
decent
a subset,
number, even
right?
a subset. I mean, I've been studying the German history very carefully. And, you know, the monopolists at first, they were a little bit resistant, but eventually they kind of talked each other into it. And it wasn't that many people.
Mm.
You know, like 8 or 10, maybe heavy industry. It's only like 5 or 6 guys decide this is our guy.
And, you know, part of when you study that time or history is, this is a line actually from a novel, but it's from Philip Roth's book, Plot Against America. But it's something I think about a lot when you think about economic policy. And there was a line in the book that said it was the kind of event that the present considered unlikely and the future considered inevitable. And when you think about pre or early Hitler Germany, a lot of decisions that were being made, there was no one really, there were very few, if any, people understanding the unintended consequences of the coalition of the monopolies in Germany.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that's right. You know, the Germans had taken a different way. They thought the American, so America waged war on its own monopolies. The Germans thought that was foolish. I've been very struck by reading about that period, by the understanding that a monopolist is in its way a dictator, right? And in its way has very similar interests to a nationalist leader or a fascist leader, because neither of them really wants accountability. The one doesn't want competition. The other doesn't want voters. But in some sense, they're quite similar. And so the danger of a return to fascism is the fear that the monopolists and the leader realize their interests in common. Mm. And that's what happened in Germany. And that's what happened in Japan. Happened in Italy as well, and in Spain. And so that's what I think we need to be on the watch for. And so the antitrust law is like a safeguard. It prevents a private power that could become as great as public or an ally to public power in ways that are dangerous. It has this incredibly important constitutional role of limiting private power.
So you would think that the Sherman Act, which led to some of the largest economic growth that we had in the 50s and the 60s. So now tell me what happens in Chicago that begins to undermine the Sherman Act that had been operating quite well since the beginning of the 1900s.
Right. So in the early 60s, there began to be a group of thinkers in Chicago who challenged the entire premise of the antitrust laws. They're anti-government people, kind of a libertarian, although they're very socially conservative. Their leaders are a man named Aaron Director, sort of not well-known, and a much better-known fellow named Robert Bork.
Who's
famous.
Not known for this, right?
Right?
He was known for not getting on the Supreme Court.
Yes. Both these men were powerful intellects, talented writers. Bork is an amazing lawyer. And their argument is, they say the antitrust law is out of control. You know, it's letting the government mess with companies. And we need not to have no antitrust law. So they didn't say throw it away. They said it has to be constrained always by this idea of consumer welfare.
Mm.
Is the law making prices lower for people or not? And that is the only thing you should ever be thinking about, and not any of these broader political or broader economic goals.
And was that any part of the opinion that led to the Sherman Act?
You mean the legislation?
The legislation. Was there consumer welfare as part of the language there?
No, but so when they passed the Sherman Act, Congress, they had a whole bunch of concerns. They said, you know, these trusts are big, they're evil, they're politically dangerous, their prices are too high. You know, so it was one of their concerns.
Yeah.
You know, high monopoly prices. Nobody
means you're controlling the price.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is a bad thing. You know, no one likes it when, you know, the drug company charges, you know, $100,000 for their cancer pill. That's
right.
Monopoly pricing. So
right.
So price gouging was one of the concerns. Bork turned it into the only concern, and also said it was only really a concern in certain when it was two companies agreeing on a price. So he
price fixing.
Yeah, it's a very narrow conception, and you know, fundamentally it was an attack on the Sherman Act itself. The idea, the attack, and you know, ultimately in Bork's vision, took us back to the laissez-faire views of the First Gilded Age.
That government should not be interfering in the operation of business. So, Tim, let's take a like a little bit of a pause in another direction before we go on to what the ramifications of that was. So if I were going, if I were going to ask you to present a counter argument to your own argument, right? So people would say you get efficiencies when you have large companies, that creative destruction is part of the advancing the world. You can't have government messing around in business. That's not their role. They should each be separate. So counter your own argument about why leaving large companies in place and not having the government interfere might look. What does that conversation look like?
I mean, it leads us right back to the Gilded Age, I think. Yeah. I mean, I think we're at the end of a 40-year experiment of trying. We've basically had very limited antitrust enforcement.
In the last
20 years, and you know, for 40 years and 20 years, very little. You know, some, but not anything like they had originally enforced the law. And we're at the tail end. And, you know, so I think the best answer is an experiment. What do we have? We have, wage growth has been stuck for 40 years. Nobody's gotten a raise in real terms for 40 years. You have an incredible concentration of income and wealth. You have most industries dominated by oligopolies, some by monopolies. And, you know, how's that working for the average consumer, average person? Sometimes they have some cheaper prices, but I think overall they're pretty angry.
Yeah.
And we're seeing again what we saw in the Gilded Age, a return to much angrier politics. Mm. I think there's a reason there's books about fascisms out right now. We're sort of back in this situation where people are so angry about the economy, so angry they can't get what they want.
Yeah.
They're willing to listen to anyone who says they're going to fix it and point to, like, the enemy.
Well, and they feel failed by everyone. They feel they've been failed by large corporations. They've been failed by government. They're just left out in the cold.
Yes.
And so one thing I thought about as—
So sorry to interrupt you, but there's your answer.
Ahead.
No, I mean, so there's the answer. We've tried it. We tried the Bork system for 1981 onwards, and I just don't think we have led to an economy that really works for people. And you can see that from the way people are voting and acting, from the widespread economic discontent. So nice try, but let's try something different.
And I think that we talked a little bit before we went live that so I'm a bookseller, so I'm clearly in a business that has seen the impact of an unfettered behemoth that the capital markets have allowed to use their free capital for a very long time. And I've often thought about writing a piece called What's the Cost of the Lowest Price? Because people are so attracted to the low price that they're not thinking that of the collateral damage, that their main street's gone, that their selection's gone, that their, you know, Amazon doesn't have a phone, that they're calling voicemail at a pharmaceutical or an insurance company, and they're, you know, they're, you have to hit 47 numbers before you find out you're still not going to get anything done. So what do you think will persuade the average person and therefore politicians to begin to address antitrust as a mechanism to combat the income gaps and inequality that exist?
So I have a number of thoughts on that.
I thought you might.
Yeah. So let's start with you know, ordinary people. I think we all like lower prices. Let's not, you know, who wants to pay more? But I do
particularly think, you have stagnant wages.
Right. That's right. But I do think, you know, this is asking a lot, but a transformation of American consciousness is important in a sense that when you think about paying things differently, you think about supporting things. What am I supporting here? It doesn't mean you want to overpay. But I mean, a lot of people, for example, have begun to buy healthier food, and, you know, animals that weren't tortured or something. Not everyone, but many people do that. And they feel like, well, I want to support, you know, sort of sustainable practices. I think more people are buying from people who make their own things or smaller business or, you know, buying directly from farmers. I think that movement is afoot, and it really transforms the way you think about money and what you spend. And maybe, I mean, the funny thing is we like the cheapest price, but then we buy too much stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's what Americans do.
Right.
We have, our homes are full of junk and stuff. And it was all like, got it at a good deal, but like, what is it doing for
us? Exactly.
So that's a big change in consumer consciousness. But I think is important because, as you said, once you start to see the side effects of everything driven always by the lowest price, you start to realize that it has these side effects you don't fully see. As for antitrust and the political will, I think it's there. Mm-hmm. I think there are, you can leave this low price conversation is one thing. I think there's many areas where people have seen it enough. They have the same kind of anger that we saw in the 19th century. They don't understand why a monopoly pharmacy company should be able to charge $100,000 for a cancer drug. They don't understand why there's only three or four airlines and, you want to bring your baggage, it's, $30 or whatever, and they just keep raising fees and adding more fees for things that used to be free, and it doesn't get better. Things are supposed to get better in American capitalism, not worse, not more expensive. And they see so many areas, they're ready for breakups. Now, they may not have the economic theory in mind, but they know when things have gotten too big, industry is too fat, and it's taken too much money from people and giving too little to workers. I think the time is ripe for a new round of trust busting, and I'm not surprised. I think this decade is the decade.
Well, I'm thrilled to hear that because I do think that one of the things that I think will contribute to it that I hear increasingly in conversations and in conversations up and down the food chain mm-hmm. is a sense that we are powerless in the face of a pharmaceutical price, in the insurance that we can access, in, think about when you're online and you want to get something and it's Facebook or somebody, and you can either read 144 pages that say, I agree to this, or just say, I agree and move on. You have no idea what you've agreed to. And do you think politicians will begin to have the will to think about it, or do you think it'll happen in the courts?
I think they should, or they're going to lose their offices. That's what I think.
Right.
I think that that's what's happening right now. I think the real divide in America are between American politics right now is almost left less of the left to right divide, although it's still there in certain areas. But on economics,
they're beginning to meet.
And on economic issues like this,
right.
Which is like, why isn't someone doing something about this? I'll turn to pharmaceuticals again. When I was in government, we had this problem. It's still a problem of jacking of prices on drugs that were out of patent. Do you remember all these things?
Oh, yeah.
What was the most famous thing? That
EpiPen.
Yeah, the EpiPen. The EpiPen, Daraprim, all these drugs. Take something, it would be like $30. There's other, when I was reading about lately, this infant seizure thing. So a baby mm-hmm. will have a seizure. The drug was raised
And they're
from,
orphan drugs.
No, this is out of patent. No, it's not orphan. It's out of patent. Somebody owns it. They moved the price from $400 a treatment to $36,000 a treatment.
Mm.
So that is literal baby killing.
Yeah.
Because some babies, if they don't have this drug, they die. So people don't understand it. And when I was in government, I was trying to do, I worked both in the state, and there's something wrong when we as a system can't do something about that.
Right.
Right. And I think the politicians who don't realize there's a problem are doomed and are going to lose their offices.
So, Tim, you were in enforcement
yes.
in the Obama White House. What were the challenges to you pursuing some of these ideas then? Or was there a moment then that you were not as clear that it was a problem?
No, I thought it was a problem. I was an inside agitator. I will say it is true that the reality distortion field inside Washington is for real. The kind of things that people want and the kind of things that even people who call themselves liberal think are possible are so far apart.
Yeah.
This pricing is a big thing. Well, the big thing in D.C. is, you can't mess with prices. And I said, where in the Constitution does it say that prices can't be, if someone is jacking prices out of control, why is that prices need to float free. You can never touch prices. That was one of the sort of mantras in Washington. Oh, you can't just target a monopoly because it's big. Oh, there's all these things. And these are, even people who are liberal, conservatives are even more. We have a problem where the market has become so sovereign, has its own kind of immunity to laws.
Yeah.
That I say it again, people aren't getting...
I don't think people realize, that to me is a fascinating concept that people have not quite focused on. You use that term in the book about government sovereignty.
Yeah.
And I think people are not understanding how that's the companion to the loss of control that they're feeling over things that impact their daily life.
That's right. So the sense of, you know, what is possible is severely constrained. Now, maybe it's starting to shift. There's on the right and left, people are getting elected who have different view of what is possible. And much of the idea of what is impossible is not in the Constitution. It's not even in the laws. It's just in this kind of mental furniture that people in Washington have. And so I think it's changing. And one of the areas I think will be a rekindling of serious antitrust enforcement. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to see.
Who do you think ought to be the object of that first?
So I have a long list of targets. where do you want to
start?
Let's
have them.
I wrote up a big 10 of the big cases that government should be bringing but hasn't brought. We can start in tech. I believe and I'm working towards a breakup of Facebook, which I think has wrongly been allowed to dominate social networking and has had disastrous results both for American elections and also for our privacy.
Yeah.
So I can't see any reason not to go after them. Yeah. I think we made a mistake allowing the airlines to consolidate so extremely. So I think they're target. This one might not be so well known. Some of them are smaller, but concert tickets. I got very interested in concert tickets.
That's like one of my pet peeves. Uh-huh. Because do you see how many fees they add on now?
Yes, I do. That's called monopoly pricing. That's what we call it.
So that's Ticketmaster being able to buy Live Nation.
Yes, Ticketmaster.
Was the latest, right?
That was a colossal error, unfortunately, made in the Obama administration. And, I was part of that administration. Colossal error. And since then, both concert prices have gone up and up and up. Ticket prices, the fees have gone up and up and up. There's nothing controlling them. They have no control. Yeah, they just do what they want. And, you know, that's been terrible for consumers. We've talked about there's so many areas in pharmaceuticals you can start. You need an entire agency devoted to rooting out the anti-competitive practices in the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, it is at every level of the industry, it's dark. We're finding that generics are price fixing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, half the time, generics are supposed to make things cheaper.
And don't you have in the book how much the pharmaceuticals spent on lobbying to block Medicare from being able to negotiate drug prices?
Yes.
That they invested $116 million, I think you said, and their return was something like 77,000%?
Yes, because they, from that investment, have, there's no negotiation. So they enjoy an extra profit of $10 or $15 billion a year. It's $116 million sounds like a lot of money to invest in lobbying. But talking about billions every year, it's actually a great, one of the best investments. It's better than buying Amazon stock.
So Tim, there's two ways to get at antitrust. And so I want to break them down a little bit. One is that you don't approve mergers and acquisitions.
Yeah.
So the example of that would be when Facebook acquired Instagram, they looked like they were a baby little company and it was vertical integration. It was video, not text, and therefore different. So you might miss that. But then the second way is breakups.
Yes.
Am I hearing that you would rather see as the first step towards antitrust activity breakups or on the merger and acquisition side?
I'm afraid I'm going to say both.
Okay.
I'm afraid I'm going to say both. Well, some of the breakups are undoing of mergers that were wrongly approved.
Right. The two we just talked about.
The two we just talked about are good examples. But yes, I also believe you should have breakups of firms that have just sat too long in a monopoly position and are keeping out competition. So I believe in that. But I think you are right to hear that I have as an immediate target reversing some of the obvious merger mistakes the last 20 years. And
right.
I think that's a full program. I think any, say, presidential candidate who took that as their mandate and said, this is what we will deliver, will have the support of the people and the winds at their back.
And do you think enforcing antitrust will also dilute the other thing that's driving our laws, which are lobbyists?
I believe so. I think that...
That's a little more tenuous, that connection, isn't it?
I agree. I think it depends. I think on average, the more concentrated an industry is, the better it lobbies. So, you know, if you have an industry of 100 people, 100 small, sometimes they can get their act together, but sometimes, often they can't. But if you have an industry, it's just three players, they have all their conferences.
The automotive industry, let's say.
Yeah, they get together, they are organized, they have an industry trade association. I think they lobby better. And so overall, by weakening, dispersing companies, I think it tends to change. Also, I'll make an important, slightly academic point. Some of these mergers are vertical. So you had two parties who used to be enemies when it came to lobbying, suddenly are made friends by a merger.
Right.
So you had a balance of power in Washington. A good example is in telephony, phone system. You used to have long distance. I don't know if your listeners still remember long distance.
But yeah, I do.
There used to be long distance companies and local companies, and they fought it out. But then the Bush administration let them all buy each other.
Right.
So now they all lobby together. So those are the clearest cases where you're letting legislative foes become unified.
So, Tim, the counter argument would be that take a country like France, that they have protected small businesses, and the criticism is they've become protectionist, meaning that bureaucratic, costly, ineffective businesses are allowed to thrive because they're a protected class. How do you avoid going to that end of it?
You know, we're so far away from that possibility.
It's not a problem.
We're so far away. And the way the French do things is a little different.
In general.
Yes. I mean, I like France, actually. Frankly, I enjoy the fact that, Paris is full of small businesses. New York, we have so many boarded up shops now in New York. That's a rent problem, a different problem. But no, I think we're so far away from that problem. And the main onus is actually to protect competition, which is protecting small business. You know, it is protecting a market where you have multiple competitors going at each other.
Right.
So we're not talking about, you know, total isolation. And I think people can actually, I think there's propaganda in the United States that says, oh, we don't want to be like France, or we don't want to be like Taiwan or Denmark. But you go to those countries. I think the greatest achievements, the role models, need to be countries that have managed to build a sustainable middle class. Countries that don't have that are wealthy, but don't have this massive gap between rich and poor. That's what we need to be looking for. You know, look at Denmark, Taiwan. Taiwan is where. It's astonishing what they've done there. And it has a lot to do with small business.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just an economy with one or two big businesses. They fail, then everyone's unemployed. It's like, you know, it's like an ecosystem. Everyone knows if you just have one tree in the forest to die, that's dangerous. You need to have a diverse ecosystem. So small and medium-sized businesses have a proven track record of creating broad-based prosperity for an economy. That's what we need to try to get to in the United States.
So, Tim, that brings me...
Can I back up and say, that's what we were. That's what this country was. It was built on that basic idea. It's not alien. You know, this is one reason the United States has often been different than, like, South America, where you often just had these monopolized, sort of dictator-like monopolies. We had a nation, still have to some extent, thriving small, medium-sized business. But we have really let that shrunk, and that's an American legacy we need to get back to.
So, Tim, that raises a very contemporary, we're having this conversation in New York City. So when I've gotten involved in any economic development work in Connecticut, one of the things that I've always believed in, that states and municipalities should not be paying big companies to come to their state. They're mobile and, you know, not necessarily loyal, but supporting small businesses not only is more adhesive to a state or municipality, it's a cheaper way of creating a middle class. So having said all that, here in New York City, the big news is that Amazon said, okay, I'm taking my marbles and I'm going home. What do you think about the kind of incentives that New York offered Amazon or states in general? And what do you think about Amazon picking themselves up and bolting?
So I share your view that too much is spent, especially by desperate communities, to try to get, you know, some, and I can understand why politicians do it. I can see the impulse.
Although the evidence has shown they've never paid off.
Never pay off. And it's, but I, And people should learn that lesson and stay away from it, partially because it's so salient. You know, you have all this news about one big company, Amazon, but you know, and it's hard to report on, you know, 500 businesses mm-hmm. that employ more people than Amazon.
Right.
Because they're, you know, they're 500.
And they're diffuse.
They're diffuse. They don't have one press representative. It's not news when three of them close. It, you know, it happens. It's like the air we breathe. It's almost the business equivalent of celebrity reporting. Mm-hmm. You know, you always report on these big yeah. stories. And I think politicians get caught up in it. And I think it's a mistake. So I share your ideas. You know, why did Amazon leave? You know, the funny thing is that New York didn't need Amazon. Amazon didn't really need New York. I think Amazon is shooting themselves in the foot. I think a company like Google knows that this is where the talent is. And
they're quietly building headquarters and adding jobs. And
yes, the Amazon's whole show and like throw money at us or we're not going to come thing backfired. So they're ending up out of, I think, really America's number two tech marketplace. And, you know, it's their own fault for going on this big parade and being so insulted when people show them any opposition.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like a bully.
They should have done it just, you know, quietly bought some buildings.
Had the conversation.
And, yeah, or not have a whole show and just start buying yeah. buildings and, yeah. you know, doing business. That's how most people do business here in New York, because you buy a building and you start, or you rent a building and you start your business. You don't say, hey, listen, I'm here. Where's my money? I mean, that's crazy.
Well, and what I'll do in closing before I ask the last question is really encourage our listeners to read the book, because I think what you've done that is fantastic is, despite the fact that you're an academic, you have written a very accessible, smart, understandable, that is not presumptive, that people understand legal theory or economics, and think about how their own actions are impacting what we're doing, because we're all dealing with the ramifications. To me, one of the worst is the contribution to inequality, which, you know, I share the idea that that can never be good without mm-hmm. a solid middle class. So I want to thank you for doing that. So I'm going to close with a question that I ask sure. all our guests, but has nothing to do with this theory, with your book. And that is, what's the book that changed your life?
Oh, that's a great, you know, many books have changed my life. I'm thinking of one, The Search for Modern China. It's sort of random, but it's this long, long history of China. Jonathan Spence is the author.
Mm-hmm.
And I became very interested in the rise and fall of civilizations, the repetitions, the way things come back.
The patterns.
And I kind of wanted us to understand America that way. I wrote this book to tell a story. I wrote this book to help Americans remember our own history, remember our own traditions, remember that we were once a country that was known for equality and promotion of the middle class mm-hmm. and of broad-based prosperity. You came to America and everyone made it here. And we right. forget our own traditions. And so, yeah, this book is told as a story of this law, the antitrust law, but really the movement to try to control concentrated private power. It feels to me we've lost that vision, and I'm hoping we can get back what is really ours.
Well, that's great. Tim, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us, and thank you for writing the book. Just the Right Book is not just a podcast. JustTheRightBook.com is a highly personalized book subscription service. It's good for readers of all ages. We have decades and decades of bookselling experience at RJ Julia's, and they're the ones who are selecting these books. Here's what happens. We get tons and tons of letters. We've been around for over 10 years, and the letters always are a version of this. I can't believe you picked out this book. I would have never picked it out. And guess what? It was just the right book. So visit justtherightbook.com for details and begin your subscription today. Of course, we have a promo code for you. So if you go to justtherightbook.com, use the promo code podcast, and you will get 15% off on your subscription at justtherightbook.com. You are listening to Just the Right Book with Roxanne Cody, brought to you by Lit Hub Radio. Produced by Roxanne Cody and Michael Selleck. Our editor is Gino Cordone at pleasantpodcast.com. The original theme music is by Kurt Feldman. You can listen to us on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can email me any comments, suggestions, observations. We would love to hear from you. Email me at podcast@rjjoya.com. I do hope you will subscribe and follow us on Instagram @JustTheRightBookPodcast. Thank you so much for listening.